Backseat Book Club, Book 4, Phoenix Rising, A Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences novel, by T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne.
Hi, this is Brandon Sanderson, author of Mistborn and the Wheel of Time series, among other things, and you are listening to the Backseat Book Club.
Hey, this is Lena.
This is Scott.
I'm Sam.
And who else have we got here with us tonight? Did we lose?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
And
there was a Chrissy at one point, so... Are we just going to go forward or try and get her back? Come on, Chrissy.
Okay. Chrissy? No. Gone.
Yeah. Oh,
all right, well, she might come back.
So she's here at some point.
We are the Backseat Producers.
We are the Backseat Producers, and this is Backseat Book Club. And today we will be discussing Phoenix Rising, A Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences book by Philippa Ballantyne and T. Morris.
No, she credits herself as Pip in this one. I'm sure that has to do with just how much real estate it would take up on the cover if she had a full name.
This is true. If I look at the Goodreads page, they have her listed as Philippa, but the book does say Pip, and we all know and love her as Pip.
Yes, she's just Pip. And before we dive right in, we do have one article of business. If you're listening to this now, you should be able to vote on the next round of books. So, you know, let's see what you've got. Vote or die.
Don't use that slogan. That slogan's terrible.
No, well, we will come after you.
Now, well, I'm not going to say, you know, some people, I'm not going to name names, may have nominated a turd.
Excuse me?
So, and, you know, someone else may nominate a douche. And you gotta make that choice between a douche and a turd.
Lena, yell at him! How dare he? He's insinuating.
Why are you being mean to my Sam?
Because you are, in fact, plotting to vote in terrible books just to make me suffer.
Once in a while, you need to suffer.
I'm saying.
You gotta broaden your literary horizon, Scott.
She's back!
Yes, but I don't need to broaden my horizons into junk.
Okay.
One person's junk is another person's joy.
Yes.
Also, clearly Scott knows nothing about romance.
Case in point, Twilight.
Slam.
It's not like we're asking you to read Twilight, honey. Though that would be pretty funny.
I don't think I want to read Twilight.
But, you know, we're not that mean. That is true meanness. We just want something cute and fluffy. It can't always be about the swords and the sorcery.
Unless there's fluffy swords and sorcery, because that would be nice.
Indeed.
If anyone knows of anything that's happy and fluffy with swords and sorcery, lay it on us, man.
But please, no Fafhrd and the Grey Mouse or fan fiction. We don't need that.
Because you think people are going to be cruel enough to do that to you.
This is our fan base. These are people that might still be sending William furry porn.
We could read The Last Unicorn. That's fluffy and it has magic and sorcery and unicorns.
I know, unicorns. Come on. How can you not like unicorns?
Right,
you know, on one podcast
on
I told
list.
You about how perverted unicorns are.
I've got to go listen to that, whatever podcast that is. Okay,
hey, Sam, speaking of unicorns, hey, Charlie, Want to go see the Banana King, Charlie?
I'm going to beat you later. Just FYI. Because now I'm going to...
See, plotting to make me read bad fiction and threatening to beat me. This is what I have to deal with. They tell me I don't suffer already.
Fun book business.
Yep.
Sam?
Yes?
Why don't you tell our lovely listening public a little bit about Phoenix Rising?
Phoenix Rising
Brief synopsis.
Well, it is the steampunk series I've always wanted in my own life, and then it happened in book form, and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But essentially, it is about Eliza D. Braun. Eliza.
Considering she's a Kiwi, my money's on Eliza.
Okay. You know, and she's a successful but not very smooth field agent who pretty much gets told
field agent for who?
I actually don't remember.
The Ministry of
Peculiar... on the cover of the book!
Sam needs a nap. Okay, for the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. And she ends up getting relocated to the Archives Division, wherein she meets Wellington Thornhill Books Esquire. And what's kind of wonderful about this series is, well, we're only talking about the first book, but it's relevant to the second book, is this is not only a Sherlock Holmes-esque mystery series, it is also Die Hard in book form.
No, it's Lethal Weapon. Come on.
Shut up. It's both. Who cares?
No, Lethal Weapon. See, Die Hard mandates that it be in a single location with one guy.
But explosions.
Lethal Weapon also has explosions, but has a mismatched team.
So who's Danny Glover?
Well, clearly books. Yes. He's too old for that shit.
I was just going to say that. He's too old for that shit.
In any case, they
And Eliza is Murtaugh because she be crazy.
I love it. I want to be Eliza. But yeah, they're a really hilarious kind of Sherlockian pairing. With gender roles completely reversed, which is part of the fun of the series. What I absolutely love is just the fact that, you know, when there's ministry business, you know, Eliza's basically got to destroy it all. And she sucks at filing. And every time she gets forced to file, bad things happen.
Things break.
Well,
Important things break.
In the first chapter, she mentions that, you know, the ministry's cut the funding, and she can either have a partner for backup or extra dynamite. And she went with dynamite.
Who wouldn't?
I was going to say, especially when you're used to kind of wearing the pants in any relationship, I'd pick the dynamite, too.
Literally and figuratively.
Yep.
But then you get into the backstory of why, you know what, maybe she doesn't want another partner. Because of what happened to her old one.
Yeah.
Her old partner being Harry Thorne.
Who's in Bedlam.
Oh boy.
Hey.
What?
I'm trying to remember what the actual name of that asylum was. Wasn't it? It was Bethlehem, wasn't it?
No, yeah. I thought it was Bethlehem, really?
Yeah, it's like Bethlehem Sanitarium. But they just called it Bedlam, because when you stick a bunch of mentally ill people in one spot with all the best care the 1890s had to offer, things don't go well.
Not so much.
No, they really don't.
The Bethlehem Royal Hospital.
That was it.
So yeah, so Eliza's partner is in Bedlam because he'd be crazy. He went missing for like a week, and when they found him, he was stark raving mad. Eliza thinks part of the reason why he went crazy is this one case that they were both supposed to work on, where people were showing up, were washing up dead. They were, like, drained of their blood, missing their skin or muscles, like, really creepy shit. And he would not let the case go. And so Eliza doesn't know if he found a lead and went crazy or what, but they were romantically interested in each other, too.
And yes, having that extra sexual tension between them doesn't really help a lot of this.
But what about the tension between Books and Braun?
Well, the tension there is very much, well, the first half of Lethal Weapon when they hate each other.
It's hard to, you know...
He just wants to sort the archives out and not go on crazy adventures and carriage chases and anything involving sawed-off shotguns. And she just keeps digging up all these cold cases, looking for connections to this.
Well, and Books does not like guns of any kind. He doesn't want to hold one. He doesn't want to touch one. Part of that being from his upbringing.
Which is very mysterious.
But you know what? You gotta love Books just because he plays the part of the stuffy librarian. He is that stuffy, leave me alone, let me do my thing. I don't need your help because you're probably not going to be help to begin with. I mean, and if you're looking at a librarian stereotype, librarians tend to be people who like to be alone. So it works out kind of perfectly here that, you know, their relationship has to start off rocky. Even though, I mean, the majority of librarians I know are crazy and talkative, and they want to tell you, like, every freaking thing ever.
Well, and at the same time, Books is bucking for a transfer to R&D, where he can be a steampunk mad scientist, but just keeps getting shuffled into the archives, and he thinks Braun is going to screw up his chances, what with the crazy carriage chases and shotgun shenanigans.
But you know what? She makes his life interesting.
I thought he wasn't too fond of R&D.
No. He doesn't like the people in it, but he still wants to do it.
Okay, because he's better at it than them. Or believes so. Or...
Dude, he made a machine that makes tea exactly right.
Oh, that is...
Gotta admit, that's kind of wonderful for all you tea lovers out there. Mind you, I don't know if books...
If you're not on the Enterprise, then that's fantastic. It's really the only place you can get it.
I was going to say, it's not like Books is somebody you would entirely want to take home to your mother, because he has his own mysteries to him that are a little iffy.
I still found him very likable.
I adore him. I adore both characters. I mean, I don't have a favorite in the case of the two of them, because I think you need one to make the other one work.
Mm-hmm. Their chemistry was very good.
And their sexual tension was just adorable.
Yes. When she was blottoed that one night and he had to take her home and get her undressed and deal with her corset. And
that he was not exactly a fan in that moment.
Well, did he, like, cut her blouse off? Or no, was it the corset that he actually cut off?
He cut the corset.
It's like, he was just like, corsets are hard. I'm just going to use my knife.
There's, like, a lot of laces and knots.
Well, she also... threatened him. She was somewhat lucid enough to threaten him that if his hands went to the wrong place,
she would kill him.
Exactly. So really, what else was he to do? Cut the corset off. He's safe.
Exactly.
She can get another corset.
Oh no, it's just even laces, man.
Never worn a corset.
I don't think they would actually be that fun to wear in some cases. Depends on the type of boobage you have. It really does.
Yeah.
I know I don't think I could get away with a corset without spilling out completely.
Part of the fun of the corset.
I feel bad for Scott.
It would be bad for Scott?
In the sense that I would be making him pick it all up.
See, I'm not seeing a downside to that.
He would hate that. Okay.
Well, I would be complaining the whole time.
That might be something that it would...
Sam, we're edging pretty close to the morality clause there, Sam.
Do I care?
Yes. You violate your morality clause, you will be penalized.
Oh.
By Tony.
I wish I could say I was afraid of Tony, but Tony likes me, apparently, so I'll be nice.
Everybody likes you, Sam.
Yay! I'm just saying.
It's Scott we're not too sure about.
Poor Scott. He is the Books in our situation.
I'm going to start my own podcast with blackjack and hookers.
You know what, though? I admit, when I was reading this book, this is going to sound so bizarre, but it really did look like Scott and I's relationship. Only because of the fact that, you know, I look at Eliza's character and I think, God, that's me, like, in a nutshell, and how I would behave in certain situations, with the tantrums and the hissy fits. You know, I look at her and I'm just like, God, it's like Pip wrote me in a book. And if I had it my way, explosives would be the way I would get out of any situation.
And that's... Scott's the calm, reasonable one?
In most situations, believe it or not, yes. I'm the not reasonable one.
Well,
okay, on the surface, not reasonable, but as you get to know more about Elsa, you realize she has a soft spot for
people.
She
does.
Because, I mean, well, first off, before she and Books met in the archives, her mission at the start of the book, where she was using all that extra dynamite, was, well, it was to kill him because he'd been kidnapped, but she ended up saving him.
Yep.
Against ministry orders. And then you look at her her housemaid.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, that's true.
She took in a woman, got her steampunk legs.
That was pretty damn cool.
Yeah, so like she has this soft side, but she hides it from people because she doesn't want to look vulnerable.
Yeah, and I mean, can you kind of blame her in a lot of
situations? Basically, yeah. As a female special agent or secret agent in the Victorian times.
She's in a tough spot. And,
the reason she was actually sent out to initially kill Books when he was kidnapped, because he is an archivist, he does not have the in-depth training that the other agents do, and they thought that he would crack quickly under pressure and give away what he knew, which was a lot. Being the archivist, he knows just about everything that goes on there.
Yep, he does. I mean, that's part of, I guess, being, you know, again, the librarian, is just, you know where everything is, you know all the information, and you deal with it. No matter mm-hmm. how disturbing or haunting it might be, you know, he takes his job incredibly seriously, and he's determined in some cases to keep a lot of that to himself because, you know, he has no reason to harm anybody, but at the same time, might come in handy.
True.
Well, so, he has a soft spot for Elsa, too, because he keeps her secrets, like when she went to Bedlam on ministry time,
yep.
And he ends up going along with her when she starts her crazy goose chase across London to try to get to the bottom of the case that put her partner into Bedlam.
Yep.
Scott, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Where their investigation takes them, the reason that her former partner, Harry Thorne, ends up in Bedlam and crazy, and a short time thereafter ends up murdered. He had discovered, was it the Order of the Phoenix or Scott?
Yes.
Can you thank you?
The Phoenix Society.
The Phoenix Society. I knew I was a little off. Sorry.
Order of the Phoenix is
Harry Potter.
The adults who don't do jack of Harry Potter.
Oops.
It's true.
I knew it was wrong, but I didn't write it down, and shame on me. What they've discovered is that Harry has kind of tapped into the Phoenix Society, and which is an ancient back from Roman gladiator days and even beforehand.
Conspiracy.
Conspiracy?
I'd say conspiracy, ancient conspiracy type guys.
Well, okay, now here's my question. Because
yes.
There was the one issue I had with this book is Bruce Campbell, who was one of the other agents. He was the one who was always hitting on Eliza.
He hits on everything.
He hits on, exactly. As you find out in the book, he has a wife plus many other ladies hither and yon. He is contacted by Peter Lennox, who is
He's in the House of Lords.
Yes, like I couldn't think of the word they use, not council, but...
Yeah, he's on the Privy Council as well, I think, in Parliament.
Yes, and basically what Peter Lennox wants him to do is basically find dirt on the ministry. They want to disband the ministry and lead England in a different direction. This was...
In which Aztec mummies do not get, you know, dynamited.
Basically. But this... They only touched on this maybe 3 times. I've not read the second book. I don't know if this continues or if this just drops off at the end of this book or not.
No, that's kind of...
Comes up.
That's what's building as the overarching plot.
I was so hoping, because that... kind of drove me a little nuts. I thought if it does, because I haven't read the second book yet, and I will soon, because I really did like this book, there wasn't enough for me to kind of sink my teeth into about why they wanted to disband the ministry. Dr. Sound, who runs the ministry, he's got some whole, there's a secret entrance and or a secret doorway down in the archives. He disappears. He comes back covered in snow. They mention that once.
Yeah, that's...
And it drove me
nuts. That's them. That's T and Pip doing some sequel baiting.
And bait they did. It made me crazy. I wanted more.
And I get... You know, we've kind of missed out on one group of characters, I think. The bad guys.
Oh, yeah!
This book has those, right?
Yes, we have a badass Italian assassin.
Oh yeah.
And she leads. So Ron gets a clue that there's some really posh doctor who was involved in some dastardly deeds that somehow tied to the Phoenix Society. So she and Bucks go, and they're going to go to the doctor's office and find out what's going on, and they get there, and then before they can walk into the doctor's office, it explodes. And I think Eliza was secretly in love with whoever did that, because apparently it was a great explosion. And then this woman in black like gets into this carriage, and they take off on this carriage chase across London, causing lots and lots of mayhem. But the assassin escapes. And then they get in trouble from Dr. Sound because front of all the newspapers. And then what?
Well, and then they actually manage to pick up on a lead and realize that the Phoenix Society is having some big highfalutin shindig to recruit more people into their ancient conspiratorial ways. Out in the country, leading to escapades of trying to infiltrate a fancy dress party. And then, you know, kidnapping, secret base, villain monologue, more fighting and explosions, the end.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. That was
Well, no, that's the plot. Like, once they hit the party, it's like, okay, boom, 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 done.
Well, I was gonna say, that's actually kind of a unique point, though, with something about pacing in this book. Those first few chapters are really slow.
Mm-hmm.
They are really slow, and they are enough to make people give up. I mean, don't give up, obviously, because the book is absolutely wonderful. But
once it starts its roll, it just steamrolls.
Exactly. It moves so fast that you don't realize how much you've even read at that point. Because of that, though, like, the beginning, being as slow as it is, it can get a little frustrating, because a part of you is sitting there going, pick it up, I know you're building something, but just make it move faster, please.
Well, part of it is a certain amount of world building, especially when you're doing quasi-alt history.
Yeah.
And you even doing steampunk, you kind of have to set exactly what rules you're playing by.
Well, not just the rules, but the tone as well.
Well, the tone is the first chapter where, you know, they blow up an Antarctic base and escape on a Zeppelin. That's your tone there.
Yes and
secret
no.
base in Antarctica, zeppelins, tone.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, for the most part. But those, you know, with those first couple chapters, you wouldn't guess that the rest of the book is going to have enough of that. Again, just do the pace. The other thing I'm a little bit annoyed with was the spoilerificness of the titles in the chapters.
Well, no, that's a throwback to Victorian literature, you know.
I'm well aware, honey.
Chapter 7, in which Sir Ponce von Fottlebottom receives a guest.
Yes, honey, who are you talking to?
Yeah, I know, but I'm elucidating for the listener's benefit.
I know, but it's one of those things where it's still fucking irritating.
Because well, there you go, Victorian literature. Victorian literature, fucking irritating.
I liked it, and it also reminded me of Batman.
Okay, that's a decent comparison.
Thank you. I was like, do you not? Because that's what you know.
Meanwhile, at Stately Wayne Manor.
I just found sometimes for me, like there were some where they were really clever and really quirky, and then there were some that were way too blatantly obvious. Like, come on, like give me a break.
Get themselves out of trouble. Oh, okay.
Like, I'm sorry. When you have one that says, "In wherein our heroes endure perdition's flames," I mean, really, like, you know what's gonna happen.
Yeah, but just they referenced Moby Dick.
Yes, and I hate Moby Dick. So let's just.
Yeah, but the Perdition's Flame line is so cool.
It is.
Especially when Ricardo Montalban says it.
I I'll give them credit on that. It's done very well, but it's just one of those, it's a little bit of a pet peeve for me.
I think one of my favorite scenes, when they went to the opera to eavesdrop on members of the Phoenix Society.
Oh, yes. I know exactly where you're going.
God, it was hysterical. And Books had this entire plot in his head, didn't tell Eliza what he was going to be doing until they got there, and then introduced everyone as his mute wife. Now, it was difficult and painful enough for her to have to pretend to be the stereotypical, meek, subservient Victorian wife. I'm sorry. She wasn't mute there. She was mute at the party.
Yes.
Although still, she was subservient. I'm sorry, but it was still my favorite part.
Oh, her having to be mute cheating. And then.
Oh, I remember that part where she goes up because they need better seats, and so she goes up to couple with the box they want to be in, and she like makes up a story about how she got the wrong box and her husband's gonna beat her. Blah, blah, blah. I know. I thought it was funny that she couldn't talk at the Phoenix Society place.
And well, that's the other thing, is that the early chapters kind of set up this feuding relationship that makes the payout of all these, you know, little revenge schemes and terrible ideas going back and forth. Just a little extra fun. A little bit.
I liked it. It wasn't a terribly technical story, which I was a little nervous that it would be, that a lot of it would either kind of bore me or maybe lose me in translation.
Well, and that's one of the difficult aspects of writing steampunk.
Well, and
this was some authors who go into a harder kind of science fiction when they do steampunk because they want to explain every minute detail about a gadget or how a steamship works, whereas here you don't have that.
This was my very first foray into steampunk. So
it was mine too, so.
I didn't really know what to expect from it.
Like I said, I think it's a nice introduction to steampunk and steampunk worlds in that it's not overbearing or overwhelming in any way. The reader can definitely pick up on how the world functions, the actual world-building aspects, and you can feel... It's very vivid. Like, you can picture how it actually looks. And,
yes, and, you know, and as and you were saying... Important. Yes. As you were saying that some other authors kind of get into way too much detail. If you're describing a gadget or a weapon, and you get into too much detail, you lose me.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to spend so much time trying to figure out what the hell this looks like in my head, I've completely lost it, and then I don't care.
But I need to know exactly how many miles of gearage the London police Babbage machines have. That's why William Gibson was nice enough to tell me.
Oh, Gibson. You know, like,
for the record, Difference Engine is awesome. Even if it does tell you how many miles of gearage the London police Babbage machines have.
But you know what? I mean, like I said, some authors need to do it because that's their way of establishing certain functions that make it steampunk. Like, as much as I adore Sherry Priest, one of the best examples is the opening of Bone Shaker, wherein she has to give you this long, and it's almost like a detailed report about the world, the gadgets, how everything works. And it reads almost like a history textbook. And that's enough to make a lot of people just check right out.
I probably would have.
And like I said, once you get past that, you know, there's a great story. But because she did that to give all that establishment and the way that she wrote it, you know, yes, it's steampunk. Yes, we know how the giant drill works. But at the same time, you know, not everybody needs all that information to understand still what the story is going to do, which is, oh my god, they're zombies.
Well, and I think that, and as much as there's sort of like a soft sci-fi and hard sci-fi, and, you know, how much the sci and the fi play, the ratios of sci to fi in that field, I think there is, so that there's a similar thing going on in steampunk, where some of it is about the setting. And in this case, it is just, hey, this is a Victorian adventure novel, but hey, here's some retrofuturism thrown in for fun.
Yeah, I mean, the setting is vivid, and it's, and you can definitely picture it, but is it the key importance to the story? No, not in this case. I think, like Scott said, it's just very much a nice backdrop to how the story plays out.
It is. I really liked it. For an introduction to steampunk, I liked it. It wasn't too much. It wasn't too little. You know, to me, it wasn't just a glossing over and mentioning a few gadgets here and there. I got enough of a description to have an image and a feel of what was going on. When all of the Transformer type automatons,
yeah,
were coming, the, you know, Mark 4, Mark 5, Mark 2, when they were all coming up at the end, there was enough going on that I could picture it in my head and enjoy how the story flowed as the movie in my head, as a, yes, you know, as I was reading along with it.
Oh yeah, I we should mention that the conspiracy is trying to take over the world with steampunk robots with, you know, gas-powered Gatlings.
And that the robots actually are, their skeleton are built of people's bones, and like the levers and everything inside the robots are made out of human body parts. Hence, all the people that showed up missing bones or skin or muscles that Liza and her partner were investigating.
Yeah, it's a little shades of Dr. Frankenstein.
Definitely. But there was like shades of the most dangerous game in it too. When they were at the Phoenix Society weekend party house
at the hunt.
Yeah, the hunt. The night before, when Liza found out that one of the other couples there was also undercover, but they were journalists, and that they'd basically talked about their journalist scheme in the room with the hearing devices. And the next morning, this couple doesn't show up, and then they're hunting, they're doing their hunt thing, and then all of a sudden, the next game they're hunting is this couple.
That was also one of the chapters that kind of sort of gave it a, you know, didn't really give it away, but gave a little bit of a hint as to, they're not just hunting pheasant, are they?
Like, nope.
I thought that I liked that. I thought it was clever. I thought it was really something that kind of knocked your brain. I liked how they handled that. Not terribly gruesome, but extremely sinister.
Well, and you know what? I gotta like the fact that in terms of the writing, there, you know, yes, it's supposed to be a really gory and horrific event, and I kind of like that there's no actual gore.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the type of scene where you'd picture somebody like Stephen King coming out and just giving you all the horrific details.
Oh,
but
then,
in this
yes.
case, it's not like you actually need the horrific details to get what's actually going on. And to be honest, does everybody want to read in detail those types of things? Not always.
Not always.
I appreciate it.
It was unnecessary.
Exactly. And like I said, I think it was handled really well. And I think what you said is absolutely true. You get the same effect just from the sort of sinisterness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Words got hard all of a sudden.
Well, there isn't quite a good noun for sinister.
No, I'm realizing.
Or adjective, yes, adjective. There we go.
Adjective. English hard.
Well, I need to unpack my adjectives.
No, forgot to unpack them.
Sometimes having a mic in front of a person does that.
Any other thoughts or comments we want to bring up?
Was I the only one who was completely weirded out by the orgy scene?
No, that fits right in. Crazy Victorian secret society, quasi-mystical.
Oh, I mean,
you need some weird sex in there.
Yeah. I'm all for the weird
sex. It's very Crowley.
It was just a little...
In as far as you felt bad for poor young Constance.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, who was being fed laudanum by her aunt so that her uncle could have his way and pass her... Actually, I didn't know if he was going to pass her around, but...
See, that one there, I mean, yes, I know the orgy, you know, fits right in and stuff, but I did feel bad for Constance because the way it's implied as being like a sort of communal property was a little... It was kind of like, ooh, okay, this is a little creepy and...
Speaking of that orgy, the only other part, because, you know, Eliza had to make an appearance, although she pretty much knew what she was going to do. She knew she was going to make an appearance. She was going to entice as much as possible and be able to make an exit. Books was never there at all. And I was, like, he went up to his room and went to sleep. And I understand he was very distressed by it all. But I was surprised that the members of the society didn't fault him for not being there. Especially because when he, you know, when he showed up with his wife, the mute wife,
yeah,
and she was being ogled left and right, he made a point of saying, you know, we haven't been married for that long, so we're still learning about each other, and I am very protective of her. She has to go to the orgy. That's pretty much made clear, but he didn't go. I thought he should have.
Well, when this is clearly a very dude-oriented orgy, you don't really care if, you know, one guy decides to skip out. Especially when, you know, the redhead that you wanted to show up does.
Yeah, but I guess the problematic aspect is the fact that he says that I want to protect her. Yes, I know that Eliza's more than capable, but it's kind of interesting, and Lena's right, he skips out, but he actually stresses in that sentence, protection. So I'm kind of with Lena in that regard. Yes, on one hand, you know, I do think he should have been there as well.
And I just, and you know, fine, he wasn't going to be there. No one really said anything to him about him not being there. And that's really my only, I thought maybe someone should have said something.
Well, see, the way I took it was that he made a big deal about how he wants to protect his wife, but then he kind of in a way is showing that he trusted the other men, that, yeah, like, I'll let my wife go to this orgy. And then I thought the reason why they didn't end up talking about it was because wasn't the hunt the next morning?
Yeah, they've got, you know, journalists to
yeah,
chase
so I think
with.
That kind of, like, washed over any kind of, oh, you weren't at the orgy.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. I see that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I can see where you guys are coming from. Like, it does seem kind of weak.
I mean, real. The only criticisms I have to me are minor. That the fact that the teases were such small teases. They were huge, but they gave you so little of it. Bruce Campbell, Peter Lennox, Dr. Sound. You know there's something huge going on, but you get such the tiniest little taste. And damn it, I wanted more.
Well, there you go. Well, there's, you know, a
they did
of
their
radio
jobs.
Dramas and a short story collection and a whole nother novel with more coming. It's a, like, in that sense, it's a very good first entry because it gives you, you know, it gives you the taste.
Yes.
And it says, okay, there's more coming.
It absolutely does. So they more than did their job in that respect. And I've always wondered, you know, when two people write a book, if I think back to Stephen King.
Peter Straub there?
Yeah, with Richard Bachman and...
And Peter, yeah, Peter Straub.
Yeah, when they wrote a book, you could, I mean, page by page, you can say, King wrote this, King wrote that, King didn't write this. But I'd be very curious to see how they literally collaborated this story. Were parts written side by side and then kind of edited together? Was it written together? Both of them talking out a story?
Well, here's hoping Tony comes through for us and we get that interview with T and Pip.
Absolutely.
So we can ask this question.
That's kind of why I brought it up. Because I do want to know that. And I know that at one point, Tony did throw a tweet their way when we thought we were going to be recording last week. Oops.
Whoops.
That's okay. Better late than ever. It's only been a week.
Well, you guys won't notice at all.
No. Because it'll still be released when it's supposed to. We just give ourselves a gigantic window to play with this.
Yep.
All good.
Have we, for the most part, touched on everything?
I think so, unless anyone has any other talking points to bring up.
Did anyone notice the little error about Magellan being a Spaniard?
Clearly I didn't.
I'm very forgiving towards that one, because it's like...
I think that it was just, that was what Eliza thought.
Yeah.
Eliza does not come across as well-educated. No. One continental's the same as another.
Well, that's that they're next door to each other.
I was just going to say, he was Portuguese.
The only reason I mentioned this is because I was...
The other thing was he was working for the Spanish.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, the only reason I mentioned this is because I could not believe how many people on Goodreads were whining about that, and I'm thinking...
People whine on Goodreads?
I know. But I'm thinking to myself, I'm like... Clearly, you don't get Eliza's character, because it's true. I mean, you know, she wouldn't have that information. She wouldn't know it. She'd just look at it as like, he must be Spanish, because he works with Spanish.
Spanish
She's
name,
putting them together.
Spanish fleet. Yeah. Spanish guy.
Like, I don't know. I think I would do the same thing. In fact, I think I have done that before.
Ay, ay, ay.
Like I said, people... I guess I'm always amazed at what people complain about, because sometimes it's totally legit and sometimes you kind of look at that person and you just want to go, really?
But yes. I haven't complained about something today. Let me think.
Well, considering how much you love the book, Lena, I mean, is there really a lot to complain about?
Nope.
There's, I mean, like I said, I think we touched upon all the actual minor issues of the book, but to be honest... You kind of don't even care about those minor issues because you're having fun reading it.
It didn't take away from what I liked from the book. It just made me say, damn it, I want to know more.
Yeah. And that's a perfectly acceptable way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. The only way that would have been a bad thing is if there wasn't another book.
Oh, goodness, yes.
If this was truly a one-of book, then I would have had a huge fault with them introducing these side plots and these other characters and then going nowhere with it.
Indeed. But you know what? Considering how much of a sequel bait was throughout the book,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you felt kind of safe. Being like, okay, you know what? So they're not going into too much detail. Hopefully in the next book. And then they give it to you in the next book, and you're happy. So clearly what Lena and Christy need to do is go read Janice Affair.
And I have Janice Affair sitting on my coffee table that I could read.
Why aren't you?
Because I'm reading the other book you gave me, Let's Pretend This Never Happened.
Which is also a great book.
And I'm reading Paper Towns, because I have, I've developed book ADD, and reading one book at a time is not enough for me.
No.
I've done that, and it's never a good thing for me.
Well, I'm happy with it, because sometimes I'll be like, I'm not in the mood for this, but I'm in the mood for my other book, and it works out fine.
Yep.
Oh, I do. I was looking to see if I had the Janice Affair on my Nook, and I do.
Well, there you go.
Which is good, because I started reading Life of Pi because there's a local book club that I go to, but I am skipping that one, the one for Life of Pi, because everything happens at the same time, and I just don't have much money to deal with it. Because they, even though it's only $1 for the book club, they go to a restaurant, and even though everyone says they don't mind if you don't get anything to eat, they kind of do.
Oh, geez.
Well, you're sitting at a restaurant.
Yeah.
Even if you just get a soda, everyone, they just keep wanting to. But that's okay. I started reading it, but I'm sure Life of Pi is good. I just couldn't get into it at the moment. So that will be put aside for a later date. And perhaps I actually think the next thing I'm going to start reading is The Janice Affair. Because I want to know more.
As you should.
And what would be lovely if we do end up getting this fantastic interview with them, perhaps even getting a little bit into the second book.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
Which is but another
speaking
reason.
Speaking of things we're reading next, what's next month?
Next month we are reading Battle Royale by, please forgive me if I get this wrong, Koshin Takami?
Koshin Takami.
Koshin Takami.
Wait, is it?
No, it's not Koshin.
Mr. Takami.
No, I think that's... I'm pretty sure it's Koshin.
Is it Koshin?
Yeah. Let's call him.
Koshin, yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah, Koshin.
Okay, Koshin Takami.
Because it's an older romanization style, but yeah. No, that should be Koshin.
And it's translated by Yuji Oniki.
And I did see the movie from this book, Battle Royale, so I'm really looking forward to reading the book.
It's a good story. I mean, just one word of caution. The first edition translation is not the best. That's the one I used when I was writing my honors thesis. It has a lot of grammar, syntax, spelling errors.
Mm.
It's like it didn't properly go through an editor. So that's a word of caution. That being said, if you get the one that was published in 2009... that one has got a fixed translation.
I think the 2009 one is the one with an intro by Max Allen Collins.
Yep.
Yes. Odds are, if you're looking for it in a store, you're going to
find
it.
Only.
You'll find the 2009 edition with the brand new sticker proclaiming it to be
a new translation.
Proclaiming it to be the original survival game.
Which is not true, because Stephen
Hunger
King did
Games.
It first.
Yeah, that's...
What are you talking about? A most dangerous game was written in 1924.
I know, I'm teasing. I always forget about that one.
That was creepy, man. When I was in grade 8 in art class, our art teacher read it to us while we were doing art.
That's cruel.
It was fantastically. It was fantastic, but it was also really friggin' creepy.
I guess my brain just associated it with Stephen King, because, I mean, he really is the guy who took the blood sport genre and just made it into something more horrific most of the time. I mean, you, a long walk makes you cry like a baby every time, because it's just like, oh, this is so exhausting.
So you're a Stephen King fan, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you read 11/22/63?
No. I have not read it yet.
Read it. Read it.
Okay, I will.
I still need to read Running Man, the other semi-sport novel book.
600 some odd pages, I inhaled that book.
Excellent.
It was... I really, really enjoyed it. And you know what? I'm looking, and I could have sworn... I could have sworn I had Battle Royale on my Nook, yet I am not seeing it.
It might be on your account, but not the...
Well, I'm looking on the account online, so I haven't... Yeah. Because my Nook is all the way over there.
Well, if
it's
there...
Away from the computer.
Yeah, it's away from the computer. It involves me moving, getting up, doing...
I am debating rereading this one. On the other hand, my brain is also going, you've read it four times, twice for your honors thesis. Do you really need to read it again?
Wow.
Yes, like, you do.
Clearly I do.
Or, Sam, I can lend you the manga, and we can do like a bit of a comparison between the...
Oh, novel. No, not the manga again. I have nightmares. Nightmares of that.
All right, I think this is a good enough teaser for next time when we go into more detail. I don't want to waste all our good material now, so we'll catch you in a month.
In a month.
Happy reading, everybody.
Yeah. Backseat Book Club is a Backseat production. Visit backseatproducers.com for more shows. Join the discussion and make suggestions for books on Goodreads.com. Music by Kevin MacLeod.